Welcome to the City's Backyard with Matt the Z-Man Zacho, a podcast that interviews all walks of life from their own backyard. The City's Backyard starts now. We are in the backyard of Greenport, Long Island, with a legendary drummer. His name is Corky Lang from the classic rock group Mountain. Corky has a book out. It's called Letters to Sarah, which is his mother's name. And, you know, Corky has, he's been around the whole, well, the whole country, the whole, some other countries, which we'll talk about, you know, when you toured, Corky. But this is the City's Backyard of New York City. And, you know, you've lived in Fairfield County. You've lived in Nantucket. You've lived in the Village.
To make it simple, Matt, I go back pre-Civil War. It's an old, I'm an old guy.
Well, you know what? You're in great shape for your age, and you're still playing drums, which is unbelievable.
Yeah, that's my savior.
So, and you even have new music out, the Toledo Sessions?
Yes. Yes, I do. It's just coming as we speak. It's just being released. You just overheard a conversation we have on a promotion man who's sending out the press releases for Toledo Sessions. And I got to tell you, Matt, the response is quite something. Very, very impressed. You know, it's really cool because the record was recorded a year and a half ago. So we put it on hold, like a lot of musicians, for the pandemic. And it's coming out now through the summer when we start touring, hopefully in August.
So let's talk about the book. And the thing I loved about the book was just your ups and downs throughout your career. I mean, you know, you're a famous musician, but you've had your ups and downs. So everybody who reads or listens to the audiobook like I did can relate to you because you're human, Corky. You're not, you know, this perfect superhero. You're a musician that's had to, you know, go through the ups and downs of fame and, you know, getting screwed over by management. So let's talk about your early days. You grew up in Montreal. You played hockey. You had a big family. Tell us about your childhood a little bit.
Well, again, the way you're talking about it is pretty accurate. The book in capsule form came about. My manager at the time came here to Greenport where I was rehearsing for a rock opera, and she found boxes that I had stored. While I was playing and rehearsing, she walked around and she discovered this box from that my mother had put together from all the letters I had sent her over like 30 years when I was on the road with the local band. And as things moved along through the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I would constantly write her when I got back to the hotels, wherever they were. And you probably know, and if there's any musicians out there, you know, it's pretty quiet after you do a show. And you go back and there's nobody around in most cases, unless you have four or five hookers. That's a whole different story. But the point being is that I had the time to write, and I loved to write my mom, and she loved it. And I guess one of the agendas was to keep her informed about where her youngest son was. I have older triplet brothers and a sister, and it was a big family. I had my grandma and my uncle. It was in order to be noticed, I had to do something. So the first thing I did when I was, I guess, 10, 11, was to beat the shit out of my drum set that I somehow put together over the years. And that was number one. And then when I hit the road, I would just write her. And she kept these letters, Matt. She held on to them over years and years. And Tuja, my manager, discovered them in this box. And I didn't know my mother was saving the letters. And at the time, my manager said, you know, maybe we could fix your Wikipedia. between you and I, Matt, I had no idea what a Wikipedia was. Sound like a bug. But she said, you know what? Maybe we can use the letters because there were dates over the 30 years, you know, whether I was playing Armpit, Nebraska, or I was playing Carnegie Hall, it didn't make any difference. I still went back to a quiet hotel room in most cases. And I would write, and she kept these letters. And Tuya says, why don't we use the letters as a bit of, you know, windows of time over those years and fill in the blanks with the stories. And hence you have Letters to Sarah, which are basically, I guess you could call it some sort of memoir insofar as it does talk about what happened to me over those years. And it was also therapeutic. You know, I mean, it's kind of like right now I'm in a very sentimental vibe because I'm in the, you know, in the last lap in my sunset years, which could go on for another 50, 100 years if things go well. The point being is that at least there's a record myself for myself of what I did before I lose my mind. It's there in the book. And I appreciate you, you know, your kind words about the book. It was a wonderful thing to do, to write. And Tuya Takala, my manager, again, she's a doctorate. She's really credible in writing, and she did a great deal of college and academic writing over in Finland. So the book hopefully has what I would consider to be a consistent, credible flow. It's not like I was writing one of those memoirs where I'm snorting ants off the kitchen table with Ozzy Osbourne. It doesn't really get into that kind of decadence. And I never did that, by the way. I don't do ants. I think I go to ant rehab. Anyway, so the point being is that's sort of the story of the story of Letters to Sarah.
Yeah. And, you know, I can kind of relate to you in a lot of ways, even though you're 20 years older than me. When I was maybe 2 or 3 years old, your song was on the radio. And like you, I came from a family of I had 3 siblings and an older brother who is 60 years old now. So he was the one that introduced me to all those classic rock bands that were basically on his AM transistor radio, listening to the big city stations out of New York. So it was, well, Bachman, Turner.
God bless him. Thank you very much. It was very good. By the way, I got to tell you quickly, when you talk about the transistor radio, way back when I was in the studio, I actually dropped by the studio when Felix was producing Jack Bruce, and he had just finished recording Goodbye Cream. And I noticed every time he mixed, he used a transistor radio for the final mix. You know, I mean, a lot of people don't know what a transistor radio is today, but that was the, I guess, if it sounded great in a 2-inch transistor radio, it would sound great with the high fidelity technology today. But it was funny to see this little beat up, you know, transistor radio sitting up there on the desk. And that's the way he did final mixes.
That's
and
interesting.
He went through all the quadraphonic thing. Remember that? Quadraphonic.
Oh, yeah.
Each instrument would be in the different part of your head. It was quite involved. But the transistor radio, that was it. And the good news for us, or for me, was, you know, Mississippi Queen was, it was at the radio stations that reached the beaches. So like all along the East Coast, we were very lucky. You know, I remember walking around those days, listening to The Doors over and over and over again. And I remember saying, boy, it would be great to have a song that reaches the beaches, you know, and we did. And hey, God bless your brother. And, you know, whatever it is, keeping in mind, and yes, we move on in life, but the repertoire from Mountain, it's just lasted. And I'm not saying there was any agenda. You played and you recorded the best you could. And even in those days, it could be kind of funky, but the music, the repertoire lasted. And I guess that's why they call it classic rock. And God bless classic rock, because it's a financial pleasure, Matt. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, after 50 odd years, I'm still getting, you know, I'm still getting royalties, which is a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And speaking of, you know, the little transistor radio, now when I preview the podcast, I use my phone sort of as a transistor radio because the podcast sounds differently on your PC speakers than it does on your cell phone.
Yeah, and it's pretty good. The cell phones are not bad, but I know what you mean.
Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, the fact that you were so young, and it is honorable that you wrote your mother when you were on the road at about 20, 21 years old. You know, you had a lot when you were young. So you got to play in front of all these people and you traveled to different countries, right?
Right. If you're going back to the early days, we're talking about the very early 60s, you know, that was right after my bar mitzvah. So it was like right back in those days. So, yeah, I didn't travel internationally at that point. But yeah, I mean, one of the advantages was the traveling and meeting different people all over Canada, Quebec, U.S., and you go overseas. It was wonderful. It was really a time capsule that, you know, good timing. I think Bill Buford said it, the drummer. He said, the thing about life has to do when you were born, right? I mean, that era of the 60s and 70s. Whatever anybody thinks on a personal level, it was brilliant. And I remember it was Carly Simon. Let me drop a couple of names. She didn't talk directly to me, but I think she wrote that to be a teenager in the 50s was to be a nobody. To be a teenager in the 60s was to be an everybody. So that timing worked. And I was very, very lucky to be born at a good time. And I think you were lucky too. Your brother was very lucky because you know what? It'll never happen again.
Yeah.
You know, whatever happened then will not happen again.
Well, Corky, I grew up pretty much in the 70s. I was born in 68, and I had the pleasure of playing Mississippi Queen over and over because most of my career, I was a DJ on classic rock radio stations. And that's also what I want to just touch on, and we can get back to it, but because I want to go to the Mississippi Queen song and how you came up with that when you were in Nantucket. But what I did find fascinating about you was you are sort of this local guy, even though you're from Montreal. I mean, you had a house in Westport, Connecticut. I want to talk about the time you broke your foot and your in-laws donated to Norwalk Hospital and that experience with the doctor who only paid attention to you once you were talking to Vitas Gerulaitis.
That's right.
Right. The tenant, he was a tennis fan. He could care less that you were a rock star, but once he knew you were in with the tennis pros, he wanted to pay attention to you. But let's go back to Nantucket and how you came up with that song. It's a great story of the hot Mississippi girl that was sweating. You tell the story.
Okay, I've said it a few times, but people seem to like it. What happened in Nantucket? It was a beach club, a really funky beach club. You know, it smelled like hell, sawdust, peanuts, and everything all over the ground. A buddy of mine, Roy Bailey, a great artist, we hung out, and he says, by the way, Corky, I got this girl coming up from Mississippi. She's beautiful. Her name was Molly. And I said, cool, cool. So fast forward that evening, it's a very hot August evening in Nantucket. And in those days, they didn't really have air conditioning in Nantucket. You didn't need it. You had the beach, you know, the beautiful wind blowing off the coast. But the few air conditioners that were being used blew out the resistor, I guess the town supplier. And at the time, you know, I was playing in a band. We had an organ, a bass player, and myself. And again, this was a hot weekend. It was like 150 degrees. And there's my buddy Roy Bailey and this beautiful girl who was wearing a knitted see-through dress. And she was absolutely beautiful. And bingo, the light goes out on the electricity on the island blows out the whole island in Nantucket. And as a result, in the club, there was one emergency light that shone on the dance floor. And there I am playing, and I'm playing up on Cripple Creek. She sends me if I spring. And this is the beat, right? You know, I'm playing that.
You're covering the band.
Covering the band, and the lights go out, and it, but I didn't want her to stop dancing. She's dancing in front of me, and I'm looking at her, and I think I took a couple of, I guess I used to call them positive pills to make you feel very positive. And I'm rolling, playing, and all, you know, the organ goes out, the bass goes out, and I'm playing up, you know, up on, and I'm saying, God, don't stop dancing. I was really into it. I was transfixed to her and her body, and she was it was very hot. And I'm looking at her, and out of nowhere, I had no microphone. I had to scream, hey, Mississippi, and I'm playing, you know, hey, hey, Mississippi. And she looked at me and I go, hey, Mississippi. You know what I mean? I'm screaming this out, right? And everybody stays dancing, including herself. So Molly's there showing, just doing it up, and I'm trying to pick her up. That's how far gone I was. And I'm looking, and she's looking at me, and I'm thinking, hey, maybe I can get lucky, you know, who knows? And sure enough, I didn't get lucky. Roy took her back to his place. He got lucky, but I saved the lyrics for that, because I remember people dancing. And as a drummer, I was just drums. It was just a beat. And I went to the cowbell. You always go to the cowbell when you want to imply dance, right? You got to keep that cowbell. And as a result, again, I think the band was called Energy, and we got fired because the owner says, you got to start playing cover songs. And in those days, hold on. In those days, here comes my phone. So hold on a second.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, we're in an interview.
Sean, are you there? Hold on. Sean, can I call you back?
We're talking to Corky Lang from the group Mountain.
This is great. This is my agent calling.
Yeah, you see, things are happening, Corky.
It's happening, and it's right here live on your show. Where was I? Yes, my buddy Roy got lucky, and I kept the lyrics, and we went back to New York to, you know, we had to go back and find some work because I had a, you know, when you cross the border from Canada to U.S., you get permits. And the permit runs out. So we wanted to make sure we got as much work in New York as we could during the permit time. So I'm sitting there in this hot loft in New York City after we get fired from Nantucket. And I remember that I'd written out some lyrics for Mississippi Queen. And I remember telling the guys in the band, the other two, hey, can you help me out here? I need some help. I think this is, and they're looking at me going, Corky, we don't even have a record deal. What are you writing? I said, I don't know. It just feels right. It's got a nice feel to it. And I needed some rhyme in Mississippi. I needed a place, you know, a city that I can refer to in the song. Way down around, I couldn't put New Orleans. I couldn't put Little Rock. It had to be two syllables. I needed it. And I said to the guys, you got to help me. I just need a city with two syllables in Mississippi. And a buddy of mine who I was staying with, David Ray, I hope you're taking notes, said to me, I remember going, I said, David, you know, and he said to me, Quark, there's a place called Vicksburg. And I went, Vicksburg? There's a place called Vicksburg? And I immediately put it in the song. And anybody out there that knows about writing, it's all about phrasing and punctuating certain things. And Vicksburg is a very percussive word, Vicksburg. So it fits right in, way down around Vicksburg, around Louisiana. So it worked in terms of a rhyme. So I had this lyric, all right? This lyric I kept and I put in my back pocket. Being fast forward to September of 69, Felix and Leslie are putting Mountain together. And they asked me, do you think I could handle it? Boy, I said, yes, sir, I certainly can. Anyway, so there I am with Leslie in his apartment. He actually moved to Park Avenue from Queens because his first record was doing really well. You know, Leslie West Mountain. Any case, I'm rambling a bit. Stay with me. What happened is I go to, and we're sitting in his apartment. Hey, Clark, you got any lyrics? Because Leslie has some great feels, you know, licks and all that. I need a lyric. So seriously, I pull out this paper that I saved with Mississippi Queen. It's a lyric. The whole lyric is right there. You know what I mean? About it way down. So I wrote, and I handed it to Leslie. I put it on the table within a New York minute. He has got the lick and he has the vocal and he right there, just like with it, like we wrote it in a limousine. It was right there. The song was pretty much finished. It just needed Leslie's beautiful, rustic voice along with his brilliant guitar work. And the lyric was right there. So that is the story of the beginning. We brought it to the studio. And Felix says, yeah, this is great, great, great. So we record, we do a rough track, put it down. And Felix says, no, we can get this better. And at the time, you know, we're jamming on it. Anyways, as it turned out, we did 14 takes, right? And the one we used was the first take, which
of course,
what happens all the time.
Yeah. Let me interject for people that are listening that may not know. Felix Pappalardi produced the band Cream, but he also played bass with you guys on Mountain. And then later, you know, Mountain was short-lived. It was only a few years. And then the band West, Bruce, and Lang came out, right?
Right.
And Jack Bruce. Well,
the transition from that quickly is that we were 69 right up until 72. We were over in England, actually, doing an English tour, a UK tour with in 72. And at the time, Felix, he just said, you know, I'm really burnt. I need a break. Apparently, he said one of his ears was going out. And Leslie and I looked at each other and said, we better get some shit together here because, you know, Felix is going to take a break. At the time, quite a few things went down in London because a lot of bands were breaking up at that time. Coincidentally, Mott the Hoople, Free, you know, a few of those bands were disbanding. So there were a lot of musicians running around looking to put something together. At first, we got together with Paul Rogers over in Watts, from Mott the Hoople, and we jammed at Island Records. It was the most wonderful time, though. We just had this recording studio at Island, and we had musicians coming and going, but mainly we had, again, Paul over and myself. Simon Kirk wasn't around, thank God, because I wouldn't have never played in that ensemble. Anyways, Paul Rogers came out with a great song that we started. We recorded it. Anyways, we go back to the hotels that week. This is January 72. And while we're still on the road with Mountain, we had some dates to play. Jack Bruce had come back from playing with Tony Williams. I think it was Tony Williams' Lifetime. He had finished the European tour, came back, somehow got in touch with Leslie. Leslie says, hey, you want to jazz? So we asked Jack to jam with us down at Island Records. Sure, he came down, and that's when West, Bruce, and Lang just blew it. We just jammed for it must be hours and hours in the studio, and it was the most fun. We're talking about lots of energy, and that's when we sort of spun off into West, Bruce, and Lang of that year. It was
let me ask you this. So, and you bounced around a lot, staying at other people's lofts and apartments. Tell me, you stayed at Ian Hunter's house in Chappaqua. He had a lot of money.
At that time, Ian was very frugal, and, you know, he had come over. He had a lot of success over in the UK. He came over, I think he came with Mick Ronson at the time. And at the time, I had already finished my first solo record with Elektra Asylum, the best record company. They had the best people. It was brilliant. And what happened is the head of the company, Steve Wax, who was a big fan of mine, said, by the way, we want to put a super band together. And Ian Hunter's looking for something. And I knew Ian from being on the road. We were on the road with Traffic, Mott the Hoople, Mountain. Great time.
10 years after.
And so, yeah, going back and talk about it, was bouncing around like a basketball. You got it. And I got together with Ian, and yeah, we hit it off. And he says, well, who are we going to get? Who are we going to get in the band? Anyways, I'm not going to start dropping a lot of names, but the bottom line is we ended up with Mick Ronson coming over, who was one of the most brilliant guitar players ever. And we started jamming with that. And we, at the time, Andy Fraser from Free was playing with us, but he had something going on in Arizona. Felix came in, so we had Mick Ronson, Ian Hunter, Felix Pappalardi, and myself at the record plant, the power station. And that's when we put together that particular ensemble. And that's a whole other story that I could tell you about.
Yeah.
You don't have enough time on this particular podcast.
What I found interesting, Corky, was that You didn't really like Los Angeles. You decided not to move out to the West Coast. You've always been like an East Coast guy, which I kind of, you know, found that interesting. You bounced around.
I want to correct you. It's not that I didn't like, I loved LA and I loved the whole West Coast. There was a manager named Arlene Rothberg who managed Linda Ronstadt, Diane Keaton, all the Carly Simon, you name it. There was a sisterhood that was managed by Arlene Rothberg. And a lot of those artists were on Elektra Asylum Records. And at the time, Steve Wax put me in touch with Arlene Rothberg. And she was brilliant. And she says, Corky, you will be the only male in my, they called it a stable at the time. And I went, well, that sounds all these. But I got to tell you, Matt, I was terribly intimidated. I went to dinner with all, you know, you name it. Bette Midler, you know, these girls, and that they're at the height of their career. Come on and join us at the table. And there I am like, wow. And who's the guy that sang Lowdown? Muskaggs. He came in and we're talking and he looked at me, you want to sit down? I said, I got to tell you, boss, I don't know what to say. You know, and anyways, what Arlene told me, I'd love to manage you, but you have to move out. So what happened is I went back and we were settled in Nantucket. I had this really small little cabin on the beach and I loved it. You know, it wasn't a big deal, but I decided not to move to LA. And as a result, who knows what could have happened, could have, would have, the whole thing. But I did make that decision and I went back to Nantucket and started again with my second solo record, which again happened to be with Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson, which by the way was amazing.
And that was the era in the book you explain this, and again it brought back memories as a kid, you know, with my brother's albums in his bedroom, and he was at that point he started listening to Elvis Costello and, right. And you made the point that the punk new wave scene was coming in and you were trying to kind of just change with the times. Classic rock was sort of what was going on there. It was
in the shits is what it was. It was like, you know, the punkers hated us. We were like, we were the dinosaurs. And between you and I cut my hair. At 1981, March 22nd, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I said, I gotta give up this long hair. And I cut it. And again, that's in the book. We started a band called The Mix, and it was off to a pretty good start. It was all right. And what I'm getting at
is that when you were living in Westport?
Yes, it was.
That was the 80s.
Yeah. I moved to Westport and I loved it. And you got me. Talk about brain farts. I got to remember all this shit. You're
I got you going. Here's the thing. I want to take a break and I want to come back and I want to talk about a few things and I don't want to forget. So I want to, you know, jump around sort of like, you know, you did your whole life during your 20s. You worked with Meatloaf, but you didn't go on tour with them because you got into the corporate record scene where you became an exec. You also had dinner with Peter Frampton, who I introduced and met a couple times in Westport, and you worked on a little project there with him. Yep. And then also, I like the story about, and this is the ups and downs of you being, you know, just human and not always having the perfect life. You were working for a driving service in Westport, and sometimes you wouldn't admit that you were Corky when people would recognize you, and you would say, "Nah, you got somebody else." But there was a time where you met Tommy Hilfiger, and
that was great. Yeah.
He was a big
Mountain fan, but this is before he became the Tommy Hilfiger that he was going to become.
So let's take a break, and we're going to talk about all that when we come back with Corky Lang. It was basically Gordy. And then why did they call you Corky? They couldn't say Gordy, your siblings?
My real name is Lawrence, Matt.
Lawrence.
Gordon Lang. And my brothers couldn't. They were 2 years older than me, so they couldn't pronounce Lawrence. So they tried to pronounce Gordon, and it came out Gorky. And from then, as we move along, it's a very exciting trip I took with my name. But yes, it went from Gordon to Gorky to Corky. And we'll take a break on that.
Yeah. Okay, Matt? Yeah, we're going to take a break with the guy who, when he was 21 years old, he was part of this awesome, successful, hard rock foursome called Mountain. It's Corky Lang in the city's backyard. More coming up with Corky right after this.
The Reading Beer Company is open. Check out a variety of all the usual suspects of independent craft beer, from the American Wheat Ale and East Coast IPA to great specials like Connecticut Porter and Reading Ole Ale. Order online at readingbeer.com. At Reading Beer Company, their mission is to make exceptional classic and historic beer and ales. The Reading Beer Company, 7 Main Street, Reading.
Bistro Mediterranean and Tapas Bar is open and serving the best tapas in town. Come enjoy dinner and choose from their wide selection of red and white wine, sangria and cerveza as well. Bistro Mediterranean and Tapas Bar with 3 locations, Westbrook, East Haven, and Norwalk. Check out their delicious menu at BistroMediterraneanAndTapasBar.com. Order Bistro to go as well for curbside takeout at 36 Westport Avenue on the Post Road in Norwalk. Enjoy happy hour drink prices Monday through Friday from 3 to 7 p.m. along with their full dinner menu including tapas. Enjoy lunch specials for only $12. Plus, come into Bistro Mediterranean and Tapas Bar and enjoy a free glass of wine or sangria with any entree.
The Wall Street Tavern in Norwalk is now open with their cool rock and roll decor. Check out their great menu, a delightful offering of appetizers, soups, salads, sandwiches, wood-fired pizzas, and delicious entrees and desserts. From the wood-roasted all-natural half-chicken to the grilled dry-aged New York strip. For more info, log on to WallStreetTavForTavern.com. That's WallStreetTav.com. 102 Wall Street, Norwalk.
From hot to cold, breakfast to lunch, JV's Deli has something for everyone. Having a family get-together or need to feed the working crew, JV's Deli and Pizza has options to feed the whole team. JV specializes in thin crust pizza, deli sandwiches, pasta, and more. JV's Deli and Pizza, serving Norwalk for over 10 years, 15 Tierney Street, up the road from City Hall. Check out their great menu at jvsdeliandpizza.com.
The Drive-In Concert Series returns to Milford Performance Center for another year of great outdoor music and fun in front of the old Sears parking lot in the Connecticut Post Mall. Tickets on sale now for awesome tribute bands like Last Child, celebrating Aerosmith's 50th anniversary, No Quarter, the Zeppelin tribute, Connecticut Grateful Dead All-Stars, and the American Pink Floyd show. For tickets and upcoming shows, log on to MilfordPerformanceCenter.org. How about a great sandwich for lunch or a delicious breakfast and cup of coffee? Check out Francesca's Cafe and Grill right on the Post Road in Norwalk, 249 Westport Avenue, featuring salads, wraps, and hot and cold specialties and classic hot sandwiches. Sergio does it all, from Italy to Norwalk, from coffee to cannolis. Francesca's is truly a piece of Italy right in the heart of Norwalk. Check out their great menu at francescasdeli.com. Who knew the sleepy suburbs would be so popular? You're listening to The City's Backyard.
We are back for another segment with the legendary drummer from Mountain, Corky Lang. The king of the cowbell is I guess what I would call him, because Leslie West didn't really like the cymbals. He liked the cowbell, and I've been listening to Mountain all week. You guys really did rock out. Let me ask you, who would you compare Mountain to if there was a hard rock band out there?
Probably the Partridge Family.
I think I love you.
Yeah. I don't know. See, at the time, little did I know that Led Zeppelin was on the road at the same time as we were in 69 into 70. And I don't know that we ever got compared to them. I mean, most of the time, Matt, we were compared to Cream. And Ginger Baker was not a big fan of that because, you know, he had his own vibe on that. And I remember in the Music Express, New Music Express in England, I don't know, somebody said, wrote something in the op-ed about me and Mountain and the way I played like Ginger. And Ginger responded to that in the next paper saying, that fucking Corky can't put a fucking candle to me. And I said, I said, yeah, that's true. I mean, I was a big Ginger, you know, I love Ginger, but I had all these opportunities to meet him. at different parties with Buddy Miles. And I always stayed away from him because I respected him so much as a drummer. But as a human being, I had my questions about him. And I fast forward that to when I was last year, 2 years ago, I was putting a package together with Kofi Baker, Ginger's son. And I found out a lot of things, and Kofi's a brilliant drummer himself, but I found out, and I think Kofi, you know, has talked about that. His father never encouraged him right up until the end. His father very much put him down. And I'm sorry to say that the information that I got from Malcolm Bruce, who I played with, and keep in mind, this is kind of unique that here I am playing with two of the sons, two of the people's sons who I highly respected, you know, Jack Bruce. I mean, I met Malcolm in 1972. I think Malcolm was a year old that I held him in my arms.
Wow.
Here I am 30 years later playing with Malcolm, who is brilliant. And so is it was Kofi. Coincidentally, here I am playing with these guys. And they're, you know, they're under a great deal of observation as to whether they compared to their dads.
Let's
got to be a hard thing to live up to.
So you did your share of partying back in the day with Mick Jagger and Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, tell me about what was the magic powder? Was that cocaine?
I don't know. I just keep in mind the story. You have to. I think it's worth a couple of dollars to get the book, because the stories, I'm really not name dropping. A lot of cases, it's just these things that unfolded that in the early days of Mountain, we play at the Fillmore and everybody would show up, you know, everybody. I mean, all musicians, they, you know, we watched each other very carefully. I mean, in most of the shows at the Fillmore, Kiss showed up. But they were not Kiss yet. But all the guys, it was a really fraternity and sorority of musicians that showed up. And this one night, Jimmy, I didn't know this. We heard about it, that Jimi Hendrix was in one of the tiers along with Bob Dylan, just sitting there. You know, it's the Fillmore. It's back the old days. And at the end of the show, you know, we had a lot of promotion people coming in and stuff. So I went upstairs at the Fillmore to the third floor to a very quiet, dark dressing room up there. And I get in, I start stripping down and stuff. And over in the corner is a human being in the shadows with a beautiful hat and feathers. I didn't put it together. I just was quiet. I don't know what's going on there. It's the Fillmore. And sure enough, it was James Marshall Hendrix that stood up and walked over. He says, "I'm sorry, man. I don't mean to disturb you." He knew that I just finished playing and I was wiping myself down. And I said, you know, it was fucking Hendrix. I said, "Jesus, no problem, sir. No problem." And he says, and he takes out this little silver package and he says, "Would you like some magic powder?" And I said, "Hey, Matt, Jimi Hendrix, whatever he's offering, I take." So when you say, "What is it?" I don't know, but I imagine it, you know, it wasn't that drastic. But sure enough, you know, he says, "Here you go." And I said, anyways, so we just had a bit of a discussion and he was very polite. He walked out very quietly and that was it for that time. And then, a lot went on in those days because everybody was crossing paths, playing same label in England as The Who. We were also at the same hotel, when the Stones were there. And this was Wes Bruce and Lang, and Jack was very friendly with Mick Jagger. So I hate to make it sound like I'm dropping all these names. Right. As long as I drop them properly, I think you can forgive me. But it was just a time and era, like when I was sent to take care of Eric Clapton in Montreal, because Jack had overdosed as a result of him reading a terrible interview on Disraeli Gears that came out. This was back in the 60s. And Felix called me because Cream were playing in Montreal at the Forum. They were supposed to play. And I think the show was canceled or postponed. And Eric was stuck in his hotel. And again, this was not when Eric was the king and the god of guitars. And Felix asked me to go and keep him company because Eric didn't know anybody in Montreal. not to mention the language was a bit different. So I did babysit, you know, Eric, and we got along. Again, I have to keep reiterating, I hate sounding pretentious. It's not that way. This was real. No. Kind of hanging out the right old-fashioned way.
Yeah, you didn't sound pretentious. But speaking of Westport, let's just talk quickly. So you had dinner with Peter Frampton. You tried to do a little project with him. You were kind of collaborating with Meatloaf music.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I can be specific.
Yeah.
Peter and I were friends over the years. He had moved to Pound Ridge, and I was living in Westport. And somehow he said, do you want to come up to a studio? I went up to a studio in Pound, had a great time hanging out. And then he said, yeah, I'd like to come to Westport. He says they have a good Mexican food restaurant. I don't eat Mexican, but he says, let's go out to Mexican food. And so we're sitting there and we're talking about my brother happened to have a connection with the offshore boat racing. You know, those huge, huge boats. They go
cigarette boats.
Yeah. And they're out on the middle of the ocean. In any case, I said to Peter, I have an idea to do a script for a movie using those boats. I had access through my brother, Steve, who was marketing those cigarette boats. And we went down to the Hudson River where they were, they run the offshore boat races up the Hudson. And I connected with a few people and Peter and I came up with the idea of what was it called? Fire and Water. And it was a story about a Westport kid and a Long Island kid who would, grew up in their family building these boats. Great story. And we were going to write the music ahead of time. In other words, so we worked on this and it was really fun. And we got a lot of reaction at the time between you and I, Matt. I don't know what happened afterwards, but, all these boats that we had, the Gene Company, the Popeye Chicken, they all owned these boats. So Peter had carte blanche when we went down to visit. And this was a time when Peter was going through quite a few, harassments with management and different things. He was having some managerial problems. I don't know exactly what it was, but at the time he was sort of off doing his own thing and I was off doing my thing. And of course, when Mountain was doing some videos, Peter would come down with his wife at the time, Barbara, it was hanging out. And Peter Frampton had just got dissed so bad because of the Sgt. Pepper's movie. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
The Bee Gees and all. It was a bad time for the people that have peaked.
You had mentioned Miami Vice kind of screwed up the movie because.
Well, yeah, they came out. They came out with that movie. And it was, in this case, it was about a lot of the drug trafficking, et cetera, et cetera. And that was a big show that was coming up.
Let's hit on the artists in Westport, because that was kind of interesting.
Go
so
ahead.
You would say you'd be walking the beach in Westport where you had a home. You were out of work. You were doing this driving thing. There's so much with your career where you had ups and downs, but you sold some old drum skins.
That's a funny story. And I tell everybody, you got to go to the book.
Yeah.
Right now, Matt, I am a promo slut. This is my little window to push the hell out of it. What happened was I couldn't get arrested during the mid-80s, as the 80s. And this is before I went off and Meatloaf hired me, which was a savior. But before that, I didn't know what to do. And I was working for a driving service with a buddy of mine, Terry Cohn, who happened to have just worked for Epic Records. He was the top sales guy, promotion guy, an amazing character. The guy was he was actually a musical head, and he was responsible for the East Coast. All the artists, Alice Cooper, Cindy Lauper, all those people would have to come through New York to the stations that you know about in Norwalk and Bridgeport. And I would hang with Terry, but then he got, I think some way he got let go. And we were both sitting on the beach and he says, listen, I know some, if you want to make a few extra bucks that nobody will know, a driving service. In other words, I would drive, long story short, it saved my life because I would make cash every day if I wanted to drive, taking people from Connecticut to the airport. At the time, a lot of the people in the, well, of course, Westport, they didn't want to bring their cars, their Audis and BMWs to leave them at the airport while they went away for a weekend or whatever. So the driving service would pick them up, drop them up, and then pick them up on the way back, saving them from having to leave their car open, you know, at the airports where they were getting robbed. Anyways, it was really good. Terry Cohn, God bless him, may he rest in peace, was a very, very close friend. And that's, let's put it this way, it's the beach in Westport. You know, everybody hangs on, you know, was it called Sound? Any case, Westport was a hub. It was a hub.
It and brought artists. Well, let me say this to you, Corky. Listening to the book, listening to you narrate it, when you do talk about the letters, you kind of are in a little bit of like reverb, a different sound of recording. So it's like kind of like you're going back in time when you read the letters. So the audiobook, and thank you for turning me on to audiobooks, because you are the very first audiobook I've ever read or say listened to. Yeah. So you do a great job with your delivery. And it just, it flies by when you listen to your inflection and your tone, because you do great imitations of Leslie West. And so it really is a great book. And what I got out of the book was that you are this awesome rock star drummer that went through ups and downs in life like normal people. And my mom used to say that to me all the time. Just because they're famous doesn't mean they're not human, you know?
Well, I'll tell you, Matt, in the book, I think I'm very open about the fact I never dreamt to any extent that I would be where I am in life, especially the particular journey that I took. I didn't dream about being a rock star. I really just loved playing, and it was a great way to meet girls. It was a chick magnet, which was very heavy on my mind. There was free booze when you played the weddings and Sweet 16s. In other words, it was a great road to take at that time, and it took care of my college and tuition. It covered a lot of things for me, and it just led, one thing led to another. But I knew one thing in life. I don't know where I heard it. Maybe it was my dad. He said two things. Number one, protect your name no matter what you do. Protect it. Don't let anybody abuse it. Because even in those days, there were some competitors, drummers and musicians, when you played the YMCA, you know, little gigs, but people would say they would advertise you without your permission. A lot of leeway there.
Isn't however, that how the New Mountain came out? You kind of were either going to sue Leslie West or team up with him again?
Well, let's just keep this one. The next step I'm saying is I knew in those days, in order to get better, you had to hang with better, whether they're smarter, bigger, taller, musically more talented. You had to get beside people. And I've always, you could tell I'm a shy person, but I'm always the kind of guy that I love doing that. I mean, I would, if I heard a drummer at one of the clubs or some high school thing, I would immediately befriend them. I want to get close to it. And as things went on, a lot of musicians know this. It's not a big secret to play with the best. Always play with better people. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when we went to play Chicago, and Joe Cocker was a little upset because Mountain opened the show for him with the Madmen and Englishmen, whatever it was. And the manager, I can't think of his name right now, but he told Joe, you always have people on the show that you look up to or you have to challenge to be better, especially when Mountain opened the shows. You know, you could hear it 20 miles away. In other words, a very powerful opening. And a lot of times we wouldn't get hired because we actually opened T for the Tillerman. What's his name? And he had a huge hit, Cat Stevens. I couldn't believe we were opening for him. You know, he's acoustic act. He had him and the guitar, but he didn't mind because when he got on there, no matter how powerful Mountain was, he was a powerful performer, the way he sang and his phrasing, he was special in his own way. So what I'm getting at is in playing on the road and, you know, in those days traveling around, Felix Pappalardi, the leader of the band, loved it when we were next to some really great performers. That's all I'm saying about that.
Yeah. let me ask you this. So when you were, you know, you had a lot of fame when you were really young. Was it hard for you to come down off of that fame and kind of like, you know, like you said, classic rock was in the crapper and punk rock came out. You had to reinvent yourself. Was that sort of depressing? I mean, did you get depressed?
Yes. Yeah, yes, it was. But at the time, I didn't know this, but when I was on top of the world, so to say, and I don't like to say celebrity wise, because I really do not consider my life in any celebrity way. I was a musician and a player and a performer, and I loved it, did the best I could. But when I found myself being irrelevant, meaning, you know, all of a sudden I'm a dinosaur, yeah, it was kind of challenging, but I got to tell you, it was the best thing that can happen to any musician. I call it in between millions. You know, I had to make up my mind, what am I going to do here? And I told you the story about working for a driving service. And I even went into real estate for 20 minutes because the only thing that saved my life is I bought a house when I had a few shekels in Nantucket, which the value just skyrocketed.
And you rode horses, which kept you away from all the drugs.
Drugs, yeah. It saved my wife, Francie, God bless her. And there all the buddies are back in New York getting high and whatever. And I'm shoveling shit in this little barn in Nantucket. But it was the best thing to get me healthy. Anyways, what I'm saying is yes. And in the book, it tells you why I, you know, fell off the wagon quite a few times. And I was really not a good junkie. You know, I didn't really know how to pace that. And if you're not a good junkie, you're going to die. You know, I've been very lucky. If there's anything we get out of this podcast is I met you, you keep moving along and it's wonderful. You got some very kind words for the book and you're very polite about everything. I don't know about the legend thing because there's so many brothers and sisters that are dirt napping, which shouldn't be dirt napping right now. I miss them. I miss I listen to them all the time. And I appreciate whether it's Prince, whether it's, you know, David Bowie, whatever it is, they're there. And part of this career that we celebrate is the recording. And it's in the air and it's on vinyl and it's on digital format, whatever it is.
Spotify.
It lives on, Matt. You know, it's a real amazing, amazing kind of thing. Living through. It's great. I mean, I get a little
nostalgic.
So yeah, get a little very nostalgic, but it's a wonderful thing to have it to celebrate.
And how can people follow you as we, you know, close out the interview? How can people follow Corky Lang?
I believe it was started by Tuja. It's on CorkyLangWorks.com. CorkyLangWorks.com.
And you're also on Facebook.
Facebook too, I guess.
I started following you on Facebook and you have these interesting video clips where you do a little drumming and, you know, that was where I learned, not even in the book, I learned on Facebook following your page that, you know, Leslie West didn't really like the cymbal and he liked the cowbell. So I learned that from Facebook.
Well, a lot of guitar players don't like cymbals because it's right in their ear, you know?
Yeah.
And I would crash a lot. And Leslie sometimes would just take the cymbal and stand and throw it on the other side of the stage. It became part of the shtick on stage, you know, where he would do that. People think, oh man, he hates Corky. Well, maybe he does, but he's not going to listen to that cymbal, I'll tell you. But we had a good time performing because Leslie was a joy to play with. I mean, a joy, you know, and a lot of drummers stepped up to me. And boy, if you ever leave, I'm not going to mention names, but I had a great, great job. I was playing with Felix Pappalardi and Leslie West, who did not tie me down. I didn't have to play to a drum loop. I was free. I wasn't tethered in any way to play to a time, to a click track. I never had to do that, and maybe I should have, but I'm saying to you, I had the freedom of that time and era to play whatever I could or would. I'm able to play anything I want. Now, hopefully, what I'm playing, people like, at least I like, whatever it is, but it's if I could pass anything on to any musicians, you must look and see how you can work with the BPM and the metronome, but basically in your mind and in your heart, you got to play yourself and you can't be tethered.
You know, I know you played at the Levitt Pavilion and you got a bunch of the classic rock guys together for some shows in Westport. But I want to say this, Corky, as we close out the interview. You know, as a kid, I never imagined when I was that young growing up in the 70s, hearing your song on the transistor radio, that I would be interviewing the rock star drummer. And hard rock it was, but it was a hit. It was a hard rock hit. And there weren't too many hard rock hits back then. And there still aren't that many hard rock hits. But Mississippi Queen is an iconic song in the classic rock world. You're an iconic drummer, and it is really my pleasure to get to know you through listening to your book and talking to you and texting with you to organize this interview. So I just want to say to anybody listening, you can get educated, you know, by listening to the book or reading the book about, you know, the classic rock era in those days and the ups and downs that you've had. You're a genuine guy. You're a cool freaking guy. And it was my pleasure to have you in the city's backyard.
Well, I'm humbled. I'm not quite in tears yet, but I'm humbled by you, Matt. Yeah, I appreciate it. This is the first podcast I've ever done, so I hope it works.
Yeah, it's working right now.
All right. Well, thank you, and thank you again for the kind words. And we will meet again, I'm sure, and I look forward to meeting your audience, you know. And again, I probably met a lot of them because, yes, I was in Connecticut, Westport, Fairfield, Montreal, Nantucket. I'm glad to say I get around, and one of the people I get around to is you. And it's a pleasure. It's my pleasure is what I'm saying.
There you go, Matt. That's it.
That was beautiful.
I think that's a good segue out of the podcast, actually.
Absolutely.
Did you hear it?
We'll end with the cowbell.
I got to tell you, Matt, I don't do this for anybody. You know what I'm saying? I got to find a drumstick. There you go. Is that better?
That puts a wrap on another edition of The City's Backyard, a podcast with Matt the Z-Man Zacho. We'll be back next week with more interesting topics, great guests, and fun conversation about what's happening in and around your community. That's it for now. We'll see you soon.